K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good evening and welcome to the show. This is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag, and this is a pre-recorded version of the show. You're hearing it on Friday, the 28th of March, and we're recording a few days earlier on the 25th of March. Actually, we're lucky. Very beautiful spring day here, even though I know some more rain is coming our way. And I'm really pleased to have for this, as I said, pre-recorded interview, Elizabeth Minnick, who's a professor of moral philosophy at Queen's University and was for 25 years a core professor at the Graduate School of Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences at the Union Institute. And we're going to be talking about her expanded and newly released edition of a book that first came out in 2017 called The Evil of Banality, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And I would say add educator and philosopher to her bio for sure. So this is a new release of a book that came out just in the very beginning of the Trump presidency, and you say expanded. What makes it expanded? Just additional information? I know you have references several to Trump in there, so that's got to be new stuff. But what else led you not only to put out a new edition, but how to expand it?
Well, I think what I have to say first is I never intended to write a topical book. I've been working on these questions for a long time.
Yeah.
And it came out in 2017, at which point it had no references to anything immediate because it had been evolving, as I said, actually over decades, bits and bits, as I kept pursuing my questions, which I am driven by, those basic questions. And then it became topical. I was told over and over again how topical it was and how did I know and all of that. And I said, well, I would rather it wasn't, but there you are. We decided to reissue it now. It's relatively fast for a book to be reissued, but the timing seemed right. And what we did was to add a new preface, so to locate it in time now, somewhat. And then we added a paper that I wrote, but I also rewrote it for this as the 17th chapter. It's called Why Not Lie?
Right.
And that, in some ways, was one of the major impetuses for doing an expanded rather, you know, than a whole revised book. We wanted to get it out quickly. And lying has become one of the world-changing phenomena of our political lives. It's not the first time in history, but it is most assuredly very striking indeed, and very serious, greatly of concern. So we wanted to get Why Not Lie? I'm saying we, the publisher and others who told me I should do this. I'm not being monarchist here. And then I had another paper that I also somewhat rethought for this called Teaching Thinking.
Yes.
So we're trying to do to round it out a little bit, connect it more directly with where we are now. Although I'm a philosopher and I'm concerned about how we think about things, how we make meanings, how we try to make sense of things. So it's, you know, I don't bring it right down to highly specific political things. But we certainly can.
Definitely. And I really appreciated those additions. I'm glad you clarified that, because so much of the book is about thinking and mm-hmm. the types of thinking and how to get at thinking that's conscious thinking. And I appreciated the both about lying, because, you know, the whole conflation of truth to be whatever you decide it's going to be, and the absurdity of that, but also the when you talk about thinking, that the last part of the book and the various ways that you can see with the students that you work with, the way they're going to different levels and deeper levels and different methods of really thinking about things. So I'm sure we'll get into that more. But I did really appreciate those parts of the book. And I think it's certainly a worthwhile addition. But, you know, I often start these interviews by talking about people's history. And yet the way you presented within your book, you're very out front with your history as far as your mentor, your great mentor, mm-hmm. Hannah Arendt, and mm-hmm. the book that she wrote that inspired the title of your book, the subtitle of that being The Banality of Evil, the title of your book, The Evil of Banality. So it's certainly worth talking about her and her influence and how it affected you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I started working with her in graduate school, and then she asked me to be her teaching assistant. So I was able to spend more time with her than I would otherwise had the chance to do. And it was, of course, an extraordinary experience. And many people know that now. At that point in time, she was extremely controversial still. I had people take me aside and say, don't work with her. It'll ruin your life, your career. Nobody will ever touch you. Hardly. but it was not all that long after Eichmann in Jerusalem had come out, subtitled The Banality of Evil. And as you know, that was shocking to people, horrifying. How could you say that evil, and she was talking about Eichmann, who was called the engineer of the final solution, i.e. the genocide of the Jews, and other large murders too. How could you say any of that is banal, since banal means, you know, I always say it's the ordinary with the life drained out of it, the cliche, you know, the conventional, the superficial, but common coin. Doesn't make anybody think. We just hand them back and forth. How could that have anything to do with evil? So there was great shock, and there was great shock also about a couple of specific things that she said in the book, which we can talk about. Or not. I don't know how much you want to go into. I can certainly come back and pick those up. It's a very interesting topic, of course, in many ways. In any case, she was controversial, and she took me with her to a number of situations in which she was speaking, trying to talk about the book. She was invited, and people would come, and they were very, very, very angry. And she kept trying to explain what she was doing. And she would, there were personal things yelled at her and so forth. And she stopped doing it after a while because she said, people are arguing with me about a book they haven't even read. She was, you know, because by then it had become notorious and everybody thought they knew what it was about. I sat in the back of the room and listened to all of this as a graduate student. And at some point, it occurred to me to wonder if she had said the evil of banality rather than the banality of evil, if people could have started listening to her sort of at the beginning of the thought, rather than coming in at this huge conclusion that was so, you know, against what we're used to thinking. And that sat in the back of my mind for a whole lot of years, associating with the notion of how do we become banal? What is it that it does to us? How can it be associated with evil? My phrase became, how can it enable evil? So that's the origin of the title and the connection.
It's interesting that that was such a controversial idea at the time, which, as you say, is no longer controversial. And I'm sure through her work and the study of that, but also your work and that of others over these many years. And you're saying about the ordinary with the life drained out of it. I love that phrase, and the superficial is that and what is constant throughout the book is this looking at evil. And we obviously have to talk about that in more detail, the nature of evil, intensive evil versus extensive evil, which is, as I say, a topic that runs throughout, including a major portion of the book that's devoted to the flip side of that, the intensive good and extensive good. The notion that these people that we look at and these events that have happened, the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide, you talk about these horrific events that we tend to look at from a distance, and the fundamental notion that they would not happen without the participation, for all kinds of reasons, of a lot of ordinary people who in that process are going through their ordinary, banal, daily lives. And I'll throw it over to you to talk about, since it's so fundamental to the nature of the book and what you're doing, those types of evil and the definitions of them.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Jimmy. That's the, I called it the keystone in some ways of the book. I was reading along in memoirs, psychological studies, history books, testimony from trials, novels, and psychologists, trying to figure out what it was that made something like the Holocaust, enslavement, such widespread sexual abuse and use of females through time and across areas. What makes these exploitation of labor, sometimes almost unto death, sometimes unto death, what makes these huge evils, great harm doing on a massive scale, what makes them possible? What is going on in somebody's mind when they're doing it, when they're perpetrating, has become the word for all of that. So I'll just use it for across the board for such things. And I'm reading, and I'm reading things about serial killers and psychotics that have had an episode and killed somebody, and, you know, a vast array, sects. And one day I had one of those, and a graduate student of mine used to call a BFO, which is a blinding flash of the obvious. They're very important moments in life when you have those. It dawned on me that we were not, I mean, very broad, we were reduced to having to say the unthinkable, the unspeakable about such horrific harm doing on that scale. Because we were confusing it with what I then came to call intensive evil, which is to say there is horrific harm done by individuals, by small groups. It breaks into ordinary life. It shocks people. They have trouble getting back to normal. It's extraordinary. It is not ordinary. It is precisely not. And we talk about madness and monstrosity and illness and variety, possession. When you look at these large scale ones that last, the harm doing that becomes normalized, it depends on the daily work of many, many people to be done at all. A small sect cannot commit genocide. They're not equipped. They can't keep it up. Somebody who's killing out of passion, harming out of passion, prejudice or otherwise, can't keep it up for 4 years every day. You can't reach that scale, and it never becomes normal. It's always a disruption of normal. So something very different is going on when we get to these things that have become daily, like enslavement, whole economies based on enslavement. Daily lives based on enslavement. People living close in, they know what is going on. They're not filled with passionate hatred. Some are, and they're, you know, intensive in the midst of extensive evils too. But daily life is going on. So it became clear to me that a key question remains, but reformulates itself. What were they thinking? How do we get in a state that we can go do our job killing, as in some of the stories, well, many of them, but I have some very powerful quotes from people who were involved in the Rwandan effort at genocide.
Yeah, you mentioned a gentleman who goes home every night and didn't, you know, he knew a guy not well, and he killed him during the day and then went home to his family at night.
And he says, I told him about it over dinner. We didn't discuss it, and we went to bed. Oh, I told my wife, and she didn't know anything bad about him either. We didn't discuss it, and we went to bed. And he talks about at the end of the day, we would gather after we had done our work, and we would divide the spoils, and then we would go home. And this has now become it's not unusual for people to know that, you know, people would go home, the Nazis who were in the camps would then go home at night and have ordinary lives. But we hadn't sort of thought that through before. We hadn't imagined it in quite like this. So the real question becomes, what prepares us to move from being good citizens in one order to being good citizens in an utterly perverted order? How does that transition happen? And how does it happen on that kind of scale? And how is it sustained?
Let me jump in just really briefly to remind the listeners that this is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag. This is a pre-recorded show a few days before the day you're hearing it with Elizabeth Minnick. We're talking about her newly expanded version of her book, The Evil of Banality, on the life and death importance of thinking, and talking about one of the basic questions: what were they thinking, or were they thinking, that allows the kind of evil that we all, as society, pretty much consider evil, the whether it's slavery or the mass genocides that have happened throughout history. Anyway, go back to where you were. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's very important. There are people out there that we care about. When you begin to realize the dependence of the most massive harms, that once we're out of them, or if we're somewhere else entirely and are not part of them, are self-evidently horrific. Once you realize the degree to which they depend on people going on about, I keep saying normalized rather than ordinary, because ordinary is a nice rich word, you know, ordinary life, ordinary people, that's important. But to have normalized some things that ought not be ordinary is, I think, a part of the process that we go through. So I started asking what prepares our minds, and how is it sustained also? Because it has to be sustained. I mean, think about that day after day after day. You can be convinced of the rightness of something. You can be emotionally involved in hatred or some kind of perversion or something. But day after day after day, when you have to then go on fixing meals for your family, and you have to, you know, you have children and you have neighbors and so forth. That was just, it was mind-blowing to me to sit with that for a while. And there's all kinds of, we know that is what happens. That is what happens. So I thought some about the what prepares us to go with such changes, should they start, what might stop them once they start, as they start, I think I want to say, not let's say as they start, and what's then keeps them going and keeps so many would have otherwise been very good people, or just good people, it's good enough, doing that work. And that's a great deal of what I'm writing about.
Taking one step back, not really back, but when people have this fascination with the intensive evil side of things, where there's the Dahmers or the monsters who are easy to identify, or the, you know, even if they're not monsters, the shooters in the schools, or this huge fascination with true crime, and that's so popular in it seems like in podcasts and elsewhere, but that's like a closed incident. It happens. People want to hear about it and understand it for some reason. There's a titillation, of course, but that's a completely different realm than the extensive evil that really ends up causing, on an ongoing basis, as you're talking about, these horrific actions over long periods of time.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. That's a wonderful comment. One of the things that I write about in the new preface for the expanded edition is these false equivalencies, which I do some work with, and that the notion in this, there are many meanings to the phrase, but the notion here was, if the deed is horrific, the doer must be horrific. If the deed is monstrous, the doer must be monstrous. That's not necessarily the case. That's what I was finding. If that were the case, these extensive evils would not be possible. There aren't that many. And they tend, as a torturer hired by the United States, who's an interview with whom I encountered, they tend to be unreliable. And you need reliable workers to do the harm of extensive evil. So we romanticize, we do a false equivalence, which then we're not thinking well about what we're trying to understand when we're thinking about extensive evils. And we romanticize them, as you were saying, very, very aptly. People are fascinated. Sometimes it's sexually charged. Pornography likes to play with these images of dominance and use the historical, you know, uniforms and so forth. And there's a kind of awe and fascination and so forth. That's not true for most of the people who do the work for the extensive. And it harms us early on, as well as throughout, but certainly early on, as extensive evils are getting going, because we personalize them. We get fixated on one or two figures who are the evildoers. And we forget, in fact, that they could do nothing if they didn't have circles of people, concentric circles, growing concentric circles of people who will do their work. They themselves can't do it. And one of the crucial things from the book is that we have stopped extensive evils many more times than we know, simply by saying no early on. Because if we won't do it, it won't happen.
And there's a whole system of ways that kind of transition from what you call normality, normal life, into this system where the system goes bad, basically. And there's all these steps that lead there, the various incentives maybe that people have, or the need they feel to protect themselves within that transitioning system going bad. Can you talk about some of the reasoning, the incentives that people go through in order to get to that place, or to facilitate getting to that place?
Well, there would be a couple of tracks there. One of the things that I found over and over again, I'm sorry, I think I want to say this first. If we're focusing on the individuals who are doing it and not on ourselves, not on others, not on communities and so forth. We're focused on them as if they're doing it. Another alone, we're not seeing the collaboration from the very beginning of people who don't have to choose to collaborate, but they do. And then you get these spreading circles. Okay. A parallel for people in their personal lives is people will often withdraw into sort of individual decisions instead of reaching out immediately to community, to organizations, other organizations that are already strong, already active, know how to do things. No, people will go back to what can I do? And they will go back to we do this. And what's the best thing I can do? Whereas the focus, a very helpful focus, there's never any one everything, but is how do we stay in touch with each other? How do we sustain each other? How do we avoid being isolated? To keep focusing on the individual in such times is a very bad idea, because then you get people taking care of themselves and not paying attention to the fact that that moves them into the system, basically, that they can end up collaborating, which is a big, heavy word. With extensive evils, everybody is vulnerable to that. It's not just a couple of bad folks, because they can't do it without us, as I keep saying. Then I came up with this thing, which I call the trifecta. There's functioning in society regularly. There's a kind of low-level greed. There's a sort of, you know, I want a little more money, I want a little more this, I want a little more that. And in a capitalist and market system, of course, that's the engine. That's important, people. That's, you know, that's a good thing. And as they had signs in China when they were trying to change towards it, greed is good. So there's an emphasis on getting a little bit more. People who are doing that are liable to be not thinking about their own integrity, the broader safety of their community, the circles of support that are going to be necessary. They say, oh, look, I could do this, or I better stay safe, or I'm not going to say that, I'm just about to get a promotion. We stay with that. That's a flavor of that is greed. Status goes with it. Aha, if I'm good here now, that person just got fired, maybe I can get that job. Or if I line up, look, this is a new reality. This is going to get me somewhere. Holding these together in some ways in a job-holding society, most people have to have a job to live. That's a change in human history across broad scales of time. If you have to have a job, that's a dependency. Job holders, careerism. What happens is that people move into work, into sometimes it's a job, sometimes it's called a career or a profession. And that's an alternative world to the social, to the political, to your neighborhood, whatever. It has its own ethos. It has its own languages. It has better and worse standards and judgments. And one scopes it out and you learn it. You become good at it, hopefully. You try to become good at it. It has petty friends and jealousy and all that. It's an alternative world. We spend a lot of hours in those worlds. And one of the things that happens, of course, is that the attention is internal to that world. What our work is doing in and to the world is not a prime question. It's a prime question for some people. It always will be. And it will variously concern others in different ways. Day by day, one of the things, the focus is not on what I did today and how it affects the world. It is in some professions. I never want to make these unqualified statements entirely. But there are these enclosures of thought and of meaning and of relationship. And we spend a lot of time in them variously. That turns our attention, and sort of greed and status are, you know, playing in there. Who am I, and am I doing well, and am I getting better, and am I getting more? That's a kind of preparation for moving to another such enclosed system, if it offers itself. And if not moving to it has threat attached, and moving to it has reward attached, you know, we're kind of used to that. And we can sometimes just switch cultures, in effect, because that living within a defined world that has its ladders and so forth and its relationships is familiar to us. So that's one kind of enclosure that makes these things possible.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is a pre-recorded version of Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. My guest is Elizabeth Minnick, a professor of moral philosophy at Queen's University. And we're talking about her newly re-released book in an expanded version, The Evil of Banality, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking, which I assume is available on the various platforms. I know Peter, who we've been talking to through their the publication through his organization, published by Roman Littlefield. Amazon, other places available, perhaps.
Great. It is.
And I just cannot recommend it enough. One thing I keep coming back to, I appreciate you're talking about this, these compartments of mm-hmm. thinking that people are kind of locked into, because throughout the book, even you referred to it directly. But you give many examples of throughout history, but it's hard to get away from comparing it to the present moment. The Trump administration and the people who are so bought into that and bought into the message that's coming out of it. Now, I don't know if we can yet say that he's in the realm and his minions in the realm of extensive evil, but certainly he follows a lot of these patterns, like compartmentalizing thought, getting people to buy into a certain way of thinking about things, and buying, as you say, there's a whole portion of the book talking about lying, into consistent misrepresentations of the truth, and accepting that without question, without what you are is so important to what you're bringing up in the book, without thinking about whether it's true or not. In fact, not even accepting that there might be an alternative explanation for, no, the election was stolen. There's no other explanation other than that. That's just fact. The people that we're deporting are criminals and, rapists and terrorists. There's no thinking beyond that. So it's this compartmentalizing thinking, and being able to think for yourself is so important to your message. And yet these people get trapped in this way of thought. How do you think about that whole MAGA universe, if it's possible to think about it?
Well, I'm deeply committed to the idea that we should be thinking about everything. So, that makes me very anxious to have things to be called unthinkable, even when I can understand in some circumstances that they are.
Right.
And people have to do that on occasion, of course, and sometimes always. But one of the things that's striking about lying, as well as having gotten too used to living in compartmentalized, enclosed thought situations, living by cliches, by conventions, where we're not actively reflecting about what we're doing. We're not often enough startled back into thought. It's one of the phrases that runs through the book. We can't be thinking fully aware and conscious all the time. It would be exhausting. We can't do that. But we should be able to be startled back into thought with frequency. You'd be attentive enough to be startled back into thought. And one of the things that's evidently going on that's part of a pattern, of course, is that once lying becomes common, becomes virtually ordinary, and established in some kind of powerful, amongst powerful people, there is a need to make your lie true in order to keep control of this alternative world you're making. When you're lying, you're cheating on the actual world, which is complicated. You don't like it. It's not going the way you want it to. It's maybe making you very unhappy indeed. And lying is a way of escaping that, saying, well, I don't have to go along with that. I didn't do it. Not my fault. Actually, this is what's true. It's kind of so there. It's a magic power. It's a great temptation as a part of the paper. We don't think of it as a great temptation. It is. You say, I'm going to get myself out of this. I'm saying, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't do it. No. And we can lie about other people, our enemies, and get them harmed. One of the consequences of lying is then a need to keep it up and to make it true. And when you're talking about political lies, which is one of the kinds of lying that I talk about in that paper, somebody is in a position to act on the lies that they tell, they will try and make reality correspond to it. That's what they're doing. They're creating a world when they do that. They create enemies, and then they can get rid of enemies. They create the usual pattern is impure people, lesser people, people who are going to pollute us, that kind of language, people who like eugenics and social Darwinism, you say people who ought to be out of the gene pool. I believe Elon Musk talks that way quite frequently. He believes in that. He believes that the superior should be breeding and the inferior ought not be breeding. That's where you get into basic lies about who's superior and who isn't. Violations of reality. Reality contradicts that all the time. I mean, if you'll pardon me, look at the people who've just been appointed to run our major institutions. There's no evidence they're superior of kind.
Or even qualified.
Yes. Yes, I was being ironic. That's better. Thank you, Jimmy. No, I mean, that isn't why they were selected. So to say that they're automatically superior because they're there, no, but they're going to have to act like that. And if you have people around them who go along with that and make what they say when they're trying to make themselves into people who are properly running these things, then things will actually happen. We will make things true. Now, the thing, of course, reality has a way of biting back. So this is not an easy thing to do. It has to be backed up in various ways. Again, if it's a political lie and somebody is lying, somebody is remaking the world according to what they want it to be, and always it's us, people are making that possible, doing the work, changing the stuff, or enforcing it violently. People pick up guns. They don't have to pick up guns.
Right.
There are choices in these circles. Sometimes they don't pick up guns. So the need to keep the lying going, there are actually two contradictory things that are interesting. One is you need to keep the lying going and you have to try and make reality correspond. And you need a lot of people collaborating in that effort. You can't have the agency collapse overnight because nobody knows what on earth they're doing. So people have to collaborate in making that appear real. Then you have to have force early on, because there is reality out there and it is a way of coming back. There are always people who say, no, that's not true, and I won't do that. So you get forced. So you have this, you have a consistent effort to make reality correspond to your lie on the one hand. On the other hand, you have to keep changing because you want people all of these people you must have, you want them focused only on you. If you're consistent, they won't. They'll figure it out and they'll work with it. If you keep changing, there's no rules, there's no ground, there's no, you don't know what to do if you're working within these spheres or even just trying to survive or trying to understand them. So all these people end up focused on this, on one or two or three or four figures as if they're monstrously powerful, partly because they're remaking reality and we ought to be able to follow that because we're supposed to make it work. We set out to make it work. And partly because we work very hard to make it work because we're trying to get along. We want our job. We're scared. Wide variety of reasons.
Rewards. There are rewards for it.
There are rewards. There's status. There's money. That's right. So you're trying to do that, but it's changing all the time. So you can't just settle in and do the best job for this new boss in your new job because the boss changes it on you. So you can't have standing. So you keep watching and adjusting. And, you know, that's kind of habit forming.
And that's been the playbook from the, you know, day one of the new administration is jump here. You can't follow. In fact, they say that right out front. This is what we're doing. You can't keep your attention on the Education Department or the USAID or Social Security because we're going to or the FAA because we're going to keep jumping back and forth between them. So, you know, you can't really pay attention to any of that. And it's, of course, so very unsettling. One of the things that is so fundamental to you and your life history that's happening now, this attack on education, which you talk about in the book. Columbia just caved on a major issue. And I heard, it was almost like hearing a quote from your book when I was listening to the media that I can watch. I hate to admit it, but CNN, MSNBC, I can actually at least watch those and then and believe that there's a glimmer of truth there, saying that what they want the universities to do is get away from teaching thinking the way you define it or classes that are amorphous. What are they learning here? They're just, you know, there's nothing concrete being produced here. We have to give them job training. We have to make sure that when they go out in the world, they have the skills for jobs, which is exactly out of the autocrats' playbook. You don't want people thinking about what's actually going on. You want them to fill a role, and this is just the latest of these, you know, tendencies.
Well, indeed, the emphasis. Actually, it's a very long history in American education. There's always been a tension. I mean, it's really fascinating to trace it back. There's always been a tension between practical, so-called, education, preparing somebody to do something, and what's been called the liberal arts traditions, more the arts and sciences, which have been more meaning-oriented, art-oriented, creativity, imagination, thinking, so forth. There's always been a struggle between these two. But certainly, again, in recent years, the emphasis on preparation for job right out of college has worked its way very much pre this latest administration by some time, worked its way into colleges and universities to a remarkable degree. Liberal arts have been in trouble. The humanities in particular have been in trouble for a number of years. Education had already, unfortunately, not across the board. There's wonderful stuff out there. There are dedicated teachers.
I'm talking to one of them.
Thank you. Well, I'm dedicated anyhow. Thank you. Oh, dear. That the effort to evaluate our colleges and universities that followed on that turn towards practicality, we've had all kinds of outcomes measurement. Corporate business models have been increasingly brought into higher education and education in general. So, which this is not a good environment for the kind of rich questioning, meaning-seeking, questioning ourselves, not just the world, reflecting, developing the incredible resources of the human mind. If you start working backwards from particular goals that you're going to have achieved at the end of a course and measuring them, and those calibrated to different jobs and professions, and they had an evaluation report at one point where the prime thing was, how much did people make in their first job when they graduated? That got you high on the scale. Somebody pointed out that people with liberal arts educations actually later tended to have higher, but this was a scale that went national, maybe 15, 20 years ago. So that has been happening, as well as some other things. So we were set for some of this, I'm afraid. That's what happens. It takes time to get there. And the equation, again, not new, of what's called free market economics with democracy that's ever tighter, and almost a cliche. I mean, it's just sort of out there. You know, that's kind of incoherent, actually, because we're talking about two different kinds of relations among people, and they can be in opposition to each other. They can work well. They can be almost Siamese twins, but they can also be in opposition. And it's that opposition that, of course, the people who are deregulating everything at this point, and who are so angry at government for a wide variety of reasons, and at society, they what they're feeling is a release from what government in a democracy is supposed to do, which is also to counterbalance economics. I always thought of the government as the people's union. It's the only thing big enough to stand up for us against other countries, for our whole country, and for very large powers within our country, some of which are larger than national economies around the world, you know. So those who want to just deal in narrowly construed economics models, they would like that broken. And so would people who feel badly hurt by the economy, are badly hurt.
They demonize the government rather than seeing it as a union or a way to solve, to make things better. I want to remind people, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. We're doing a pre-recorded show for this month, recording on Tuesday, March 25th, for airing, obviously, on the 28th. Speaking with Elizabeth Minnick, a moral philosopher, I would say, and a professor of moral philosophy at Queen's University, and has been working on this topic, teaching, enlightening us for many years. We're talking about her new book that's a book that came out a while ago and is being put back out with additional information, The Evil of Banality: On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And we don't have a lot of time left. It's so fascinating to talk with you, and it's such a deep subject. And I hope, if anything else, it'll get people thinking, right? That's what we're trying to do. But you do spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about the, I said flip side, but I'm sure there's a better way to put it, of the concept that we brought up earlier of intensive evil and extensive evil to intensive good and extensive good. Similar definitions on the other side. Intensive good, we think of saints, the people who do, you know, great deeds, or groups of people who do great deeds in a limited way. But extensive good being the same thing, a dedication to doing good over a long period of time. And as you point out, there's many examples of this over history that have made a real difference. You use as your primary case talking about Le Chambon in France during World War II. So maybe delve into that a little bit.
I'd love to do that. I don't want to run out of time before I say I'm no longer at Queen's.
Okay, just, I'm sorry.
Well, that's just factual.
Okay.
But it's I enjoy teaching moral philosophy there very much indeed. Le Chambon is a little village in the south of France, up in the mountains. Protestants in Catholic France, used to being somewhat in opposition, somewhat disrespected, shall we say, sometimes worse, but intensely involved in their community. And they had a pastor, assistant pastor, the family of thereof. They had their religious, highly religious community. That's a preface to saying that they were prepared, and this is a crucial thing that I found over and over again, and I want to say it again today. They were prepared to act in time. When the Nazis were occupying France, they weren't in the south of France, but it had effects, of course. They were in charge, but you know, they were occupying mostly around Paris and so forth. But they certainly had a presence, and they were pursuing Jews who fled and were trying to get into Switzerland. And the Chambonnet, the villagers, took them in, took them over the border to Switzerland at great risk, of course, because the Nazis were there. They were prepared to do so because they had built community. They trusted each other. They knew each other well. And they talked often about how they were leading their lives and what was important to them. What they did when they are asked, when they have been asked, and I found this virtually, almost unanimously, when you talk to people who have done extraordinary things, when things have really gotten bad, they'll say, what else was I supposed to do? I'm supposed to slam the door in the face of this family that's running for their life. What was I supposed to do? What comes across is that they're doing it for themselves. It's a matter of integrity. It's a matter of remaining your own friend, having to live with yourself day by day by day so that you can go on thinking. You're not closed off with lying to yourself about what you did and didn't do, or just shutting it down. Talk about compartmentalizing, having to live with that. The people who we would want to say from outside did amazing things. Lots of people did things that were wonderful and good and sustained and were helpful. We're talking now about the ones that people want to put into different categories. Say, well, that's not me. I'm not a monster and I'm not a saint. So, I don't have to do that, or I can't do that. No, they really weren't. And they certainly don't see themselves that way. They will say, Tommy, what else was I going to do? And they come from all kinds of sectors of the population. People who were rule bound and conventional and all that, but they believed in a certain kind of personal integrity, not just external, it was personal. And when something came along, they were asked to do something, they would just say no. Like that example that I used from George W. Bush under the Patriot Act, when he told the librarians to report who was taking what out of the library to read. They individually and as a group and in small groups and then as a profession said, no, we don't do that. And it just disappeared. They were on time. It was early. He wasn't going there anyhow, I don't think. But there was some risky stuff happening, centralizing power. But when he went too far, the librarian said, that's not what librarians do. And we will not do it. As I said, they said it individually, but they knew they were doing it as part of a profession that takes pride in what they do and is aware of what they do. They think about it. So I do want to keep underscoring, as you hear here, I get very anxious about this, the in time.
Right.
The later it goes, the farther it goes, the more dangerous it becomes. Early on, only but so dangerous.
Where do you think we are in time right now with our current situation?
I think it's moving frighteningly fast. I think they know what they're doing.
It seems like it's been going on for a while now.
It does. It does. It's worth remembering always, too. with the in time. There are organizations, there are groups, more and less political, by which I mean mainstream political and other kinds of institutions that have been around for a long time. They're strong, they're experienced, they know what they're doing. They're still here. That's important. We don't have to retreat to individual selves. We don't have to say, what's the best possible thing to do? Oh dear, I can't do that. We don't have to decide to be martyrs or the opposite. We can keep going with integrity in what we do, because without us, it can't be done. And given this in time thing, we shouldn't forget, which is so important, we can't forget that it doesn't just start now. People have been working for democracy, for the principles of our that we have been trying to live up to and reframing and trying to understand for a long time. So no, you don't have to just sit there and say, what can I do? Oh dear, I can't. There's nothing. There are people who can and are. They can be supported. And people can lead their lives with integrity and build groups, get to know each other. One of the first things the Nazis and others do when they take over a country or take over a government is get rid of groups, from Boy Scouts to community action groups. Groups are not good. They want people isolated. So it's very important that we do that, and we know that those groups are there and can work, and that what we do matters enormously.
As you say, the time to be startled into truth and action is always now.
And yes.
Well, again, I really appreciate you making the time to be on the show, Elizabeth Minnick. Her book, The Evil of Banality, on the life and death importance of thinking. I think it really gave me a very insight into people that I tend to demonize as the other, as how can they think that? How can they be so, you know, to see and understand some of those motivations. I mean, I always thought beforehand that when you talk to people one-on-one, you can come to an understanding of some kind, or there's a possibility of that anyway. But when you show some of these trends and the way that people can get, it isn't necessarily give you a solution to that. But the notion of thinking, which is so fundamental to that, and the importance of it, as you say, it's the subtitle, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. I hope people will check out the book. I appreciate you being on the show. And as you say, as maybe as an academic text or an explanation of things that have happened, you didn't expect it to be so timely, but it certainly is very timely, and it's very timely for us to have you on the show. So thanks so much for making the time to do that.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. You're wonderful to talk with.
Well, I really enjoy doing it.
You really are.
Well, maybe we'll do it again. You never know.
That'd be a pleasure.
This has been Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. Thanks so much for tuning in.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.